Well, now, what about the future? I know you suggest that we're always behind ourselves in realizing what's going on.
We're always living a way ahead of our thinking, yes.
Hi, and welcome to the Pub Call, episode 14 for the week ending July 14th, 2009. The Pub Call is the netcast where we chat about the book publishing news of the week. Cassia Crozier from Quartet Press is here, as is Kat Meyer from Next Chapter Communications and the new Vice President of Marketing at Quartet. Welcome, guys. How are you?
Very good.
Good. Thank you. And you?
Well, good. What became of the Quartet slogan contest?
We had a winner.
And which I noticed. And what is the new Quartet slogan?
The slogan is for the readers, for the authors, for the stories.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Brilliant.
I like it.
I commented on that one in your post, and it never showed up.
It did not.
That's my favorite one.
It did not influence at all that you liked it.
Perfect, we totally, perfect.
Yeah, I like that one too.
Yeah.
You deleted my comment, I bet.
Yeah, we did.
So we also have a special guest this week, Liza Daly from 3press.org. Liza is the creator of Bookworm, the platform that allows you to read ebook books in your web browser. And she's also a technical editor and general advocate within the industry. Welcome, Liza. How are you?
Hello, PubCall. I'm very good.
So I'm not sure if you like self-identify as like book geek, but you're like the number one book geek I know in like a good way. So
I'm totally a book geek.
Okay. you roll with the book geek label, which is good. So it seems like kind of a slow week in terms of news. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I was just kind of catching up over the weekend, and it didn't seem like there was a lot going on. With Liza on the show, I wanted to kind of touch on some open standards around digital publishing. Maybe we'll talk ebook pricing. But perhaps we can start with the Romance Writers of America conference. Cassia and Kat, I guess you guys are on your way out to that. Can you just tell us about your RWA plans, what they are, what's going on?
Well, imagine, just close your eyes, everybody, and imagine yourself in a hotel with 2,500 women. And it's kind of like a little bit of slump.
You're saying this for my benefit.
Yeah, I'm saying this for your benefit, but I think Liza and Kat can appreciate that many women or that many people at a single conference. And it's like a big writer's party. It's definitely focused on writers. And tomorrow night is the literacy autographing. This is a massive 600 author event and it's open to the public. So what happens is these authors, their publishers donate the books. The authors sit for several hours meeting and greeting fans and autograph, and all proceeds go to, I believe the umbrella organization is still pro-literacy, and it usually raises quite a bit of money for the organization, and it's a lot of fun. So that kicks off tomorrow, and then we get to work starting at 8:30 Thursday morning.
So where is it?
It's at the Marriott Wardman in Washington, D.C.
Oh, so you're flying all the way across the country.
Yeah, that's why Kat and I are like, we really should pack at some point.
So 5 days, all romance, all the time, and this is kind of your coming out for Quartet.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So super exciting. Yay.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
I'm really excited, and I've never been to anything even remotely like this. So I've been reading a ton. As Cassia can attest, I am a newbie to the romance world, and there's a lot to learn to get me up to speed with the standards and the classics of romance. So,
well, Edward Champion just interviewed.
I know.
So there's, I guess it's the history of romance fiction. It's called Heaving Bosoms. It's by two. It's by an author team. I believe one of them's last name is Wendell.
Sarah Wendell. Yes.
Yeah. And do you know the second author?
Candy Tam.
Yeah, so they've got a new book out. Again, I'm just speaking off the top of my head, so I'm not sure of the press, but it's newish. It's about the history of romance, and they're doing press. So I've seen one review in print, and then our comrade in arms, Edward Champion, did a podcasting interview that was hilarious.
Yeah.
Over at edrants.com.
You've never met Sarah, have you? Sarah and Kim.
Not hilarious in your opinion?
She is the most... I love Sarah. I love Candy. I think they're both really smart and really terrific. But Sarah is about the quickest wit on the planet. I don't even pretend to keep up with her when she's going. Because she's hilarious and she's so smart.
It was a pun a minute in that interview. So if you're not interested in the book, check out the interview just for the interview's sake. But yeah, obviously romance is hot right now, right?
Yeah.
And so their timing is perfect. And Kat, if you want a quick intro into the history of romance, I guess that might be a destination for
it's
you. I don't know if you knew about
definitely
that.
Definitely a destination, and there's actually going to be a signing by at least one of the authors, right, Cassia?
Yeah, Sarah and Candy are doing a signing at 4 p.m. in the Vegas Palace Suite, which is a group of them are sharing a suite this year, and I've heard tell it's going to be Party Central.
You have memorized the itinerary. That is crazy. You're like, in room 24 on sub-level 4.
Let's just say there are people I email with every day, and they're part of that group.
Okay, so last week I posted episode 13 of The Pub Call on the interwebs. We got a couple of downloads, which was nice. And obviously The Pub Call is eventually going to live at pubcall.com, but I just threw it up on my personal site. And there was some feedback there from Fran Tulin of Firebrand. And I saw a press release that Firebrand is now... working with Quartet, so you guys have strengthened your relationship. And he was nice enough to listen to the show, and in regard to our discussion about the Amazon patents for ads and books, he said, I quote, "I think you guys were missing the issue of these patents. There is more. This is more like the one-click ordering thing. It's a business method patent. It's not so much about the advertising as it is about owning the ground of a likely to be future business model. It's also a way of stopping or profiting from Google putting ads on pages in Google Books," end quote. So Mr. Tulin is suggesting that Amazon is blocking competitors with this patent. I know that that's kind of the way that patents work. It's kind of a land grab, and that kind of fits with the timing of the patent filing. And so we really appreciate Fran taking the time and to send us your comments or suggestions about the show. Email feedback at pubcall.com or leave a comment at pubcall.com if and when the show ever migrates over there. So, on to the news. Cassie, you just sent through a New York Times story that was kind of a follow-up on this. I actually just glanced at it briefly, but maybe you can chime in on what it's about as we run through this. Essentially, the one story that caught my attention this week was at Bloomberg. Apparently, $9.99 ebooks at both Barnes & Noble and Amazon threaten the industry's margins. Fish shake, you know? That's kind of a given, I guess. And what some publishers want to do is delay issuing ebooks to protect hardcover sales. And I guess there's one notable example of this coming up from Sourcebooks this fall. So I guess my question kind of to the group is, By creating kind of artificial scarcity for books, these guys are trying to boost sales. And really the kind of question is that sustainable? And I don't know if that's an outright no or if there's nuance here. Does anyone want to take this on?
Go ahead. I'll let somebody else talk for a change.
Kat, you...
I have a lot of opinions. I thought maybe Liza wanted to talk.
I was going to let you guys go first. I don't have an informed opinion, which I think that the three of you are more likely to. I have a...
If you had an informed opinion, we would be on the show.
To me, the first problem just seems to be that, we hear over and over again about how this is an attention economy, and when you have the attention of the audience through the initial marketing push of a hardcover release, to me that seems like the time you want to capture ebook readers as well. And delaying that just means that people are going to wander off and buy other books, and the same marketing push doesn't happen at the paperback release, which I think is where they're expecting to do the ebook release.
I agree. I wonder if it's really completely about a worry over cannibalized hardcover sales. I mean, to a degree it is. Obviously, they've printed however many. I've got the Wall Street Journal article right here, but it's all crumpled up.
paper sales.
I know. They really don't. They don't hold up over time.
No, not even over a day. But I think, in general, I kind of wonder, is part of the issue trying to push back at Amazon a little and say, we don't want you pricing our brand new ebooks, our brand new releases at $9.99, so we're not going to let you have it. This is just my off the top of my head thinking. And if you've already got hardcover copies sitting in a warehouse, you do need to get rid of them. So go ahead, Cassia.
Well, my sense is that, and Dominique Rocca, who I have, one of my many girl crushes on, I think my list of girl crushes is extremely long, but I think Dominique is really smart and I think she has an excellent grasp on the business. But I also think, I was really surprised by how blunt Richard Curtis and Robert Gottlieb were in that Wall Street Journal article, and that they made it very clear that delaying the release of an ebook was about protecting a certain revenue stream, which, that's a fair thing. I think I personally think it's misguided because the digital book customer is not, once you become a digital book customer, you tend not to buy print as much, or you buy print differently. And so I think that there are a lot of factors in play here. One is the bestseller list issue, that only a certain sort of sale counts toward that. And so there's so many pieces to this, but when you get down to it, there's a lot of protecting a business model at a time when, as Eliza put it, it's an attention economy. You lose us, you lose us.
I was thinking that there's more threat to paperback sales from issuing an ebook at the same time as a hardcover, because a typical customer decision is about price, right? And so it's just like, wow, I'm going to wait for the paperback because it's going to be cheaper and easier to carry around. Well, the ebook qualifies as that. So you're not necessarily going to lose hardcover sales up front. You're going to lose trade paper sales a year from now, right? And I don't know if the market for ebook and hardcover it overlaps at all, or is totally exclusive, or what? But yeah, I was also surprised at the kind of bluntness of Robert Gottlieb, and I was wondering if you guys had heard other industry people say similar things, or if that was just kind of the one person that they were able to get on the phone and get a good juicy quote from?
I have not heard anybody say it that bluntly in print. But yeah, and you know, it's a scary time to be a publisher. And your comment about the digital book, the ebook, cannibalizing the eventual mass market is not so far off base. I don't buy hardcover. I don't find them terribly comfortable to read. You know, I tend to read in like these weird, awkward, curled up positions, and you know, holding a heavy book is not desirable for me. I tend to read at the gym a lot. I have lots of, so I prefer, if I'm going to read, I would prefer a mass market paperback just because of the size and the weight. And so I think that's that I'm purchasing fewer books later in the life cycle, and I'm definitely buying a lot more. And I'm doing air quotes here. Forgive me, Todd Goldberg. Hardcover releases earlier. We don't know, and that's the hardest part. Is the publishers don't have a good handle on this. Amazon, as Michael Cater will point out frequently in various pieces, is very tight about sharing data. So we don't really know who this customer is, but we can safely assume that it's kind of a mix of replacement sales, additive sales, and brand new sales. You know, people who wouldn't have bought the book in the first place. But, you know, I think under $10, that's a really comfortable, you know, that's a no-brainer purchase as opposed to, you know, that's lunch and dinner in a restaurant kind of thinking.
Right. Yeah. So Kat, go ahead.
I was just going to say the idea of does it hurt potential paperback sales is a very interesting one. I mean, in this particular case, I don't know, just source books. Have they sold the paperback rights? Are they going to print the paperback themselves? You know, what kind of contractual obligations do they have? It could be that they're worried about paperback too.
That's a great point. I often forget that paperback rights are sold separately because that's so so infrequent in my own experience. That's a great point.
Yeah.
Cassie, was there anything, was the New York Times story that I referenced off the top just a rehash of this story? Was it yet another news story about the same thing?
It's pretty similar. It's expanding beyond source books and saying that a lot of publishers are debating this. You know, it starts off with the very sexy Dan Brown, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to go e right away? Or are we going to just, you know, hope everybody buys hardcover? And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to. So it's more like an introduction to the debate that's happening inside. And the one thing, the only person that they really talk to on, I'm going to call it our side, even though it's not really our side, is Mike Schatzkin, who's quite often coming from the perspective of the reader on this. But they're not really talking, you know, so they're talking to publishing professionals in the New York Times. They're all saying, you know, we're not sure, and we've got some reasons, but nobody's coming out and, you know, saying it up front that they do have business issues, and I can understand those business issues.
Yeah, the Times article said they couldn't get anybody to
go on record.
Yeah.
So it's mushy rehash.
It's mushy,
right. There's a great tweet from Smart Bitches about, like, enforcing old business models on new readers and how it wasn't going to take it anymore or whatever.
I saw that. I can't remember the exact quote, but I saw that.
Yeah. I should have dug it up. So, Cassia, did we lose you? Are you still around?
I'm still here.
Okay.
That was me trying to just mute. And I'm a Skype newbie and I hit the wrong button.
Okay, no worries. So, from ebook pricing to the sexy world of ebook standards. Now, Eliza, the Open Publication Distribution System, OPDS, is something that's passed me by on Twitter a couple times. And having you on the show, I wanted to pick your brain about that a bit. And I was wondering if you could explain what that is and why it's important.
Sure, I'll try to make it non-boring. So I'm campaigning to pronounce OPDS as OPDES, so that's what I'm going to say here and see if I can like get this started. This is a standard that a group of us are working on, us actually a kind of diverse group, but it's being led mostly by the Internet Archive. O'Reilly, was originally started by the guys at Stanza, and then a number of other small, some small, some large, just publishing technology people, including me, the people from Book Oven, and a few other groups like that. One Laptop Per Child is definitely involved. And the idea here is that we're trying to develop a system where any given publisher or book distributor or even an individual author can broadcast a list of all of the books, the ebooks that they have on offer. And the way this will work will be very similar to RSS feeds. In fact, it's a very similar technology called Atom, where instead of like going to a website and having to drill through some arbitrary site with its own search query and browse interface like you would as a person, this is a way for computers to discover what books some site has. So instead of like just always going to Amazon, OPDES will allow independent publishers especially to be able to have a level playing field where they can say, here are all the books we have, and any reading system like Stanza, for example, can just say, okay, I know all the books you have. A reader can just go and find them. A reader can search by author using this system and get a list of all the works by that author that are available anywhere on the net. The Internet Archive is interested in this because they have ultimately millions of public domain books that they want to make available to anyone who can consume them. So the plan right now is that this summer we're gathering interested parties. There's a public mailing list. You can just search for OPDS. And mostly driven by the Internet Archive, there's a fixed deadline of mid-October where some initial prototypes and content will be available on the system. And I'll be developing one of the reading systems that's part of that ecosystem.
Great. So a couple questions then. Where does this fit into kind of the standards ecosystem in terms of IDPF and the Open Annotation Initiative and stuff like that?
Well, we're drawing from the standard called Atom, and Atom was originally developed as a replacement for RSS, but it's been extended in a lot of different domains to be a kind of general purpose way of broadcasting some content. And you know, initially it was blog posts, now it's going to be books. So we've recruited some people who've worked on the Atom standard, but in terms of the organization, it's independent of the IDPF or any other standards body.
And the open annotation stuff, the open annotation conversation comes up with Book Glutton a lot. Bookglutton.com is something that that Kat, you just profiled on Follow the Reader this week, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to talk about the annotation standards because I got the smackdown from Hadrian last time I brought it up.
And Hadrian is the principal at feedbooks.com over in Paris.
Feedbooks is really involved in this as well. I should have mentioned them as a primary. And Aaron from Book Glutton is also on this list. I think anyone that you can think of in digital publishing, we've managed to either passively or actively gone out and gotten them to at least be on the mailing list and participate in terms of like just what should this thing do and be?
So am I confused in thinking that this has anything to do with open annotations, or is this just purely a cataloging, a catalog effort, sharing catalogs?
Sharing catalogs is the primary, that will be the major thrust of what version one of this is. And this will not be very dissimilar from what the Stanza application already uses. Like when you open Stanza and it says books from Feedbooks, it's using a catalog format that's very similar to Opti's. We're basing it on that. Annotations is something that can fall out of this, but we're trying to keep the scope under control so we can actually get something done by this October date.
Sorry, my bad, my confusion. So that sounds great. That sounds like a great project. I know that this kind of came out of you guys all meeting last February in person in New York, and it's great to see that this is moving forward. I, you know, have a soft spot for this kind of stuff. I know it's not for everyone, but
by October there will be actual real world applications that non tech nerds can look at, and I think there'll be some real value in this being open and a real playing field leveler.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's move on to bookmarks for the week. Does anyone want to go first?
No. I didn't know we were doing it so fast. Yeah, give me 2 seconds.
This happened last week too. Richard and Kat were like, we don't have anything open.
I have so many. Wow, where do we start? The Stanza reader turned one year old today, or yesterday, I guess. And I'm actually pretty excited about that. But the bookmark I wanted to call out to everybody was a little, very short blog post by Fred Wilson. And he was combining some anecdotal observations about his 13-year-old son with some other data points that he found, and noting that possibly streaming media is having a blunting impact on piracy. And I think that's really, you know, I kind of falls into my long time mantra that, you know, if you make the content convenient, you make it portable, you make it the right price point, people are more likely to go with the legal option over the pirated option. So I thought that was really interesting, and I'm hoping more people follow up on that sort of research.
Great. So Fred Wilson is a noted venture capitalist out of New York City.
And I'm willing for him to adopt me. I should just put that out there in case he's looking for another child.
Or give you lots of money for
I don't want to be rude.
She's not mercenary. She wants to be adopted.
Yeah, that's true. I want to be fed.
Kat, did you have anything on such short notice as we dragged you onto the call this week?
Well, did you drag me on? Yeah, I did, and I had something even before I tried to get out of doing the call. 2 things. One is just, I think it's a really cool blog, so it's not necessarily a bookmark for a specific entry, but a blog called pimpmynovel.blogspot.com, and it's all about book publishing from the sales perspective. So there are posts all about things like book scan and what goes on in terms of selling your book through, things like that. So I liked that. And then the other one that I really liked and got a lot of attention, but in between last week and this week, there was a post by Eric Obanoff, who is the publisher at $2 Radio, called The Revenge of Print, and that's at brooklynrail.org. And it's a very interesting post. I'm trying to work through it, and I'm kind of working it into a post that I'm doing right now, but he argues I mean, the stuff that I agree with him on, he argues that it's not print that's broken, it's the publishing model and trying to put too much out there that people don't necessarily want to read, and that there is space for print in this world, but it needs to be done on a realistic scale. So I suggest everybody take a look at it. It's a nice, well thought out long post.
Yeah. I caught up with that on the weekend, and that's it. I really enjoyed that piece. It was really, really well done. And ultimately he's saying that, you know, it's like the golden age for artists and creators, and not so much for publishers, but that's just something we're going to have to get over. And that's definitely proved to be true in the music industry. And I think that he's right on the money with a lot of what he says in that post. It's really great. Liza, did you bring anything with you? I just quickly threw that into the show notes when I sent it over. We just at the end of every show just kind of share something that we've encountered on the web during the week that we think is worthwhile. I don't want to put you on the spot. So,
oh, no, that's okay. I saw it.
Okay, cool.
I did. It's not book specific, but it actually kind of speaks to the point you just made about how it's sort of a golden age for participation. It's a site I just learned about called StarWarsUncut.com. And this, as far as I can tell, is not sanctioned, but someone just took the first real Star Wars movie, and divided it into 15-second clips. So there's 472 clips, and told people to just claim them. So individuals said, okay, I'll take this 15-second clip, I'll take this one. And they're tasked with recreating that clip in a video any way they want. And at the end of the project, when all of the clips come in, the organizer will reassemble them into a whole new movie recreating Star Wars, where it shifts every 15 seconds. And so all the clips have been claimed, and people are starting to submit their entries, and right now there's just three, and even just those three are incredibly funny. It's the audio from a movie, but people have recreated the scenes like in their bedroom with a flashlight or with Star Wars action figures or with costumes that they made out of what was in their office. So I think this project will be fun to watch, and it's just totally the kind of thing that only the internet could invent.
I like this. This is totally.
I've got a big smile on my face listening to what this is about too.
I know.
So like, where can people find out more about this?
StarWarsUncut.com.
Brilliant. Kat, I don't want to steal your thunder for the third post that you have upcoming on Follow the Reader, but I did want to briefly call out the glue toolbar from Adaptive Blue. Kat's going to be writing about this probably in 2 weeks when she gets back from RWA. And Adaptive has just partnered with Random House in the US to allow for kind of technological integration of their toolbar with the Random House list on their website. And what this actually does is it's like a social network for, you know, book lovers, movie lovers, gadget lovers, foodies, etc. But the genius of it is that unlike Facebook or Ning or any other social site, Glue doesn't demand that you go to it. It's like a browser overlay for the places on the web where you know book lovers and movie lovers are already meeting and browsing and interacting. So essentially, if you're looking at a book and you want to connect with other readers, you can just do that right there in the browser, in the Chrome above the in the bookmark space above the browser window. So it's a new metaphor for kind of social spaces, and I just thought it's kind of cool, and check it out at getglue.com. So that's about it for tonight. Liza, where can people find out more about who you are and what you're up to?
You can just search for my name, Liza Daly, on OPDS that we talked about earlier. is the Open Publishing Distribution System. And again, that should just come right up if you search for it.
Cool. And Kat, where do you want to point people to this week?
followthereader.wordpress.com and/or quartetpress.com.
And you guys are going to be MIA for a week, maybe twittering, maybe
Twitter for
posting.
Sure. We will be twittering, right, Cassia?
I don't think we know how to communicate in longer than 140 characters anymore.
So, Cassie, where do you want to point people to?
I'm
BookSquare,
at
Quartet?
I'm at quartetpress.com, and I'm at booksquare.com, and apparently I'm going to be at RWA all week. So it's actually going to be a lot of fun. So next week when we talk, Mark, we'll have salacious stories to tell.
You'll be giddy with romance excitement.
Yes. we will have found love.
You can, you meaning the listener, can leave your feedback about tonight's conversation at pubcall.com or by sending an email to feedback@pubcall.com. On behalf of Liza, Cassia, Kat, and the missing Richard Nash, I'm Mark Bertils, and thanks for listening.